Good afternoon. This is the first Senate Education Committee meeting. It's January 29th. It's approximately 3:31. And with us today, we have Senator Stevens, Senator Huggins, Senator Gardner will be back in just a moment, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. We're going to have two presentations today. Before we get into a bit of the mechanics of that, it's my hope that over the next several meetings, we have an agenda that's laid out a lot with the department to try and give us some information so we can understand some of the things that the department's working on, how the department itself works, the school board, commissioner's role, et cetera, and an effort to get data for the purposes, at least for some of us down the road, if we wish to file additional bills. There are a couple that have already been filed that we have some information to also work off of. So we'll have a number of presentations here over the next couple meetings. And are there any comments that any of the members of the committee want to make before we get into the actual meeting? Senator Stevens?
No, sir.
Senator Huggins? Terrific. So today we have the Department of Education going to present the role of the State School Board of Education and the Commissioner of the Department of Education. We'll be able, hopefully through this process, we'll have a better understanding of what the role, responsibilities, duties, obligations, rights, et cetera, focus of the department is, of the commissioner, and of the state school board, and the relationship between those separate entities within that overall entity, and how it relates, hopefully how it relates to the legislature as well. So with that, I'm going to turn this to Commissioner Hanley. If you can state your name for the record, who you're with, and begin your presentation, that'd be great.
Thank you, Chair Dunleavy. My name is Mike Hanley. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development. Would you like to introduce yourself now as well?
Susan McCauley, the Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education and Early Development.
May I ask, do you mind if we ask questions during the presentation? Do you prefer that we wait?
Only in that, if you've previewed the packet, you know, my portion of the department and the state board is relatively straightforward and difficult, and I don't, or short and simple, but, and you may feel free to answer questions through that portion. I guess I would just ask prudence in the second part with your permission, just because there is a lot there. And as simplified as we made this, and we kept it at a relatively high level, it's 25 slides. I'll leave it up to your judgment. Our goal today is to provide you with a high-level overview and surely be prepared to dive into any one of these components as you see fit.
Thank you. Go ahead, proceed.
At this time or later time. But
okay.
I'll just begin with the overall structure of our department, and the Department of Education is slightly unique when we are compared to other departments in that I am not the head of our department. The State Board of Education is recognized as the head of the department.
Excuse me. I'd like to recognize Senator Giesel has arrived at the committee. It's 3:34. Continue, please.
The State Board of Education consists of seven voluntary members who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. They represent our four judicial districts. We have three members voted in at large, and one of them must represent an REAA, a regional educational attendance area. Those are very small school districts. No more than four of them can be of the same party of the governor, which is not a particular issue this time around, but it provides that balance. And they do serve at the pleasure of the governor. So looking at the role of the State Board of Education, one of their roles is to appoint a commissioner, and which is also different than other departments and commissioners. The State Board of Education appoints a commissioner, and the governor approves that the commissioner. So in a sense, I have two bosses, if you will, that I report to as I represent the governor's cabinet as well as the State Board of Education.
Just a quick comment. This is not in other states, the structures are oftentimes very different. Some states, it's actually an elected body, an elected position in which an individual runs for it and is actually elected, and it's actually very separate from the governor's office and acts independently. But there's different models throughout the country.
That's correct. And there are school board, state board members that run for office. They appoint. So you're right, there are several. The biggest difference is whether their commissioners are appointed by the board or whether they are elected positions. And there are some nuances within those. So the commissioner is appointed as the principal executive officer for the Department of Education to run, to set the vision of that, and work with the board to set the vision of the department. One of the primary responsibilities of the board is to promulgate regulations, and that is in response to statutes and the authority that they've been given to follow through to establish and maintain a system of public education. So they promulgate regulations. They do so with counsel, with the support of the department. Oftentimes they will come to me and say, we'd like something to come forward. We'd like some language in regards to this. This is an issue we'd like to address. Other times we will come to them, as we've done extensively over the last year, saying, here are some recent statutes that were passed. In regards to HB 278, we had 20-plus regulation packages that the board needed to put out and adopt just so that we could implement all the components of HB 278. So they come both ways, but they do that with counsel. The attorney that we use is from the AG's office. It also represents the State Board of Education. So when those regulations are promulgated, they are reviewed by law. They go out for public comment, but they're also reviewed by Legal. We get feedback from them if they find any inconsistencies between the regulation and statute, or if they believe that we have stepped outside of our authority to promulgate a regulation. They also go forward to the Regulatory Review Committee. So the Board of Education promulgates these, but there's plenty of oversight in the process. They also are responsible for approving charter schools and our residential schools in the state. They provide a report annually to the legislature, which I believe will be next week. Our board chairs, Esther Cox, will be presenting our report to this body in regards to the work that's been done over the course of the last year. They also set graduation requirements, the number of credits required and what those credits need to be. Most recently, they realized that we had only required 2 credits of math. And with our higher standards, it was agreed that 2 credits of math was not adequate to be prepared for the next steps, for college or careers. It doesn't determine or dictate what those credits are in, but they changed it from two credits to 3 credits. So now there are still 21 credits required, with 3 of those in math. And they also they may adopt bylaws that operate that set the guidance for how we run our department.
I have a question, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. There's a 14.07.165. A board shall adopt statewide goals. Has the board done that yearly, and have we done that this year?
Chair Donnelly, they do that. They review it periodically. They don't do it on an annual basis. Their educational goal is a relatively high-level goal. It is to the State Board of Education and Early Development is committed to develop, maintain, and continuously improve a comprehensive quality public education system. And that also fits in with their mission, that are both tied to that goal, both this vision and mission, and that is to ensure quality, standards-based instruction to improve academic achievement for all students. So that is their guideline. It's probably been over a year since they've reviewed that, but that's what guides the work. The role of the commissioner, as mentioned.
Excuse me. Yes. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, excuse me, Commissioner. You were talking about raising the math standard with 3 credit hours, so I recall. I've got a number of emails on civics, And I think Arizona is the last that, at least on record, that added a requirement for civics. Was that part of the conversation about raising standards, or was everybody satisfied, or just wasn't talked about?
Slight difference between standards and requirements for graduation. The board hasn't had that conversation recently. The only requirement we have that's named in our graduation requirements is of the three credits we require in social studies, one of them needs to be Alaska Studies class. But there is no requirement currently for a civics class.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I do believe that there is a bill that's been introduced this year to be considered in regards to that. It might fit more on the Constitution. I don't know if it's civics, but.
The resolution, Mr. Chairman. There's a resolution on civics. That
thank you.
Should help us.
That is correct. Thank you, Senator. The duties of the commissioner to be considered as, for the role of commissioner, the commissioner has to have a master's degree, 5 years of experience in education after achieving that master's degree, with at least three of that in administration. The commissioner is appointed and serves at the pleasure of the State Board of Education. So it does require the approval of the governor. So it requires both the governor and the board to put somebody in place, but it only requires one of them to remove a commissioner. For instance, during this transition period, the governor could simply remove his approval, and the board would need to go look for another appointee. Or the board could remove their appointment, the same situation would occur.
Is that what the commissioner, is that really what the statute says, that the governor could have removed you because you, from according to the statutes that I'm looking at, you're appointed by the board, and it's the board that oversees you.
And approved by the governor.
In your initial hire.
Initial hire. We actually have an era when that happened and the person stayed on as commissioner. You may
I remember that. There's been some language that's been changed because of that situation.
That was an issue of term.
And that had to do with a fixed term.
Right.
And so there is language that doesn't allow for a fixed term anymore. I guess it could be a legal question, but with the approval of the governor, if you change governors, that governor has the right to continue that approval, if you will, or not approve, I would think. I did not delve into that, but.
I and some others are trying to do is thoroughly understand what your role is, what your relationship is to the board, the governor, the legislature, what the functions are of your office, what the functions are of the board, so we have an idea on when we pass something or we get a question from a constituent, whose authority is this law or this reg or who makes a decision on this grant. My hope is that as we go through this process, when we're done with it, if there's any questions, we've got them all answered, but you may want to check on that, because according to the readings that I've done and several others, you work for the board. Anyway, we can move on.
Well, you know, and I'll just answer, just provide a little bit of clarity in regards to how I see my role in particular, and that as a member of the governor's cabinet, I serve with the governor. I believe I serve at the pleasure of the governor, because he has the ability to remove his approval. So I do represent the governor when I work here and in practice, and I represent him when I do the work of the department. So in that sense, when I speak to you, I rarely speak outside of what I believe is the vision of the governor on specifics anyway. I surely have the autonomy to speak to you about educational issues, but as you're well aware, those fine lines sometimes in regards to specific bills and things like that, I'm cautious and recognize my relationship with the governor. Now, in regards to the Board of Education, they meet quarterly, face-to-face, at least once or twice telephonically. They have other jobs and other roles and activities in their lives. They provide guidance for me. I picture, although they do have the authority to remove their appointment or unappoint me, if you will, I look to the board to represent Alaska. I look to the board to represent the voice of more than just the department and more than just the governor. I look to them for guidance in regards to what does the general public, since we represent, you know, that board represents Alaska. So when we look at educational issues, that's what I look to the board for.
Right, but Commissioner, and it's, I appreciate that. But that's not – some of the things you're saying are not necessarily embedded in law. I'm just trying to understand the relationship from a – for example, there are several of us that have been on school boards. A similar setup would be the superintendent is hired by the school board, reports to the school board, and the school board sets policy, and the superintendent would administer that policy. The superintendent would administer that policy. Just trying to find out where your authority, rights, potentially, et cetera, are embedded in law and where it's not.
Sure.
So,
okay. My previous answer to you was more in regards to how I translate the law, the statute, and the regulation into practice. AS 1407-145 says that the board shall appoint the Commissioner of Education and Early Development subject to the approval of the governor. So I see those as equal levels of authority to authority over this position.
Okay, and then we're gonna. So this question, and anyone has a question, please jump in because I don't want to monopolize this. But how do you view your school board? You've explained how you you view your relationship sort of with the governor and a little bit with the school board. But are they the policy-making body of the department? It's not a trick question.
I understand, but and I'm looking at the statutory authority given to the state board, and the authority to set policy falls more into statute and regulation. Policy is the enactment of those regulations, and that's just where I'm wrestling a little bit. Their work is guided by statute, and they do have latitude within the authority that they've been given to affect education in regards to things like what are our expectations for our students, what are our graduation requirements for students, and so they have the autonomy within that that authority given to them, but it's not a separate policy outside of the work that's done here. So and that is quite a bit different than what you would see in a local school board, who has oversight over the budget and insight onto how to. The budget that we put forward is largely the work that we do at the department and that I do with the governor. They get a chance to approve it and review it, but they have very little oversight, if you will, of that. So there is a significant difference between the state board, although you would think they would have additional authority or power, if you will. They actually have less than a local school board. So direction, vision, policy often begins in the work that I do on a regular, everyday basis. As I look for shifts and changes, I share that with the board, and we discuss those as to directions that we might want to take together.
So in Section 1407-170, number 2, says the additional powers and duties of the board, they may require of school personnel to submit to the department in the form of this looks like a typo here, but they may require the district budget or any other information from a school district. Does that happen?
Largely in regards, yes, it does. The primary place that we see that is in the responsibility of local school boards, school districts, to apply 70% of their resources, their funding to the instruction. That's the primary place that it comes to us as a department. It goes to our facilities and finances. We work with districts to help them get to 70% to the greatest extent possible. And any of those districts that don't get there, aren't able to get there, they go to the board for review and typically for waivers from that requirement. Those are districts that are relatively small. They don't have the economies of scale to meet that 70% just because of the cost of running a building and things like that.
And So in the statutes, I could not find where there is an articulated relationship between the department or yourself with the legislature. Is that correct? Laid out in law.
No, I think that's correct. I'm not aware of any specific relationship. You know, they are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature. Technically, I guess that would make them a part of the executive branch.
You have reports that have to come to us, and one will come, I think, next week, is what you
correct.
Said? Right. Okay. Any questions for members of the board on the authority of the commissioner, the board, and its relationship to the governor, to each other, and possibly to us? Senator Huggins?
Yeah, it's a little further than that, but same sphere. The relationship, the board, the commissioner, with post-secondary. Is there a relationship, or is it just parallel play?
Unfortunately, for too long it was parallel play, but our board and the Board of Regents recognized that that's parallel play doesn't benefit anyone because we have a big chasm between these two entities. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of years ago, we've started to bridge that gap, and our state board has began working directly with the Board of Regents, mostly around the idea of teacher preparation, making sure that we have the highest quality teachers in our schools and the work that they're doing to get that training in our university system, and also around the idea of dual credit opportunities. How can we partner together and provide those at both the high school and the university level for the sake of our kids? But you are correct that they have been dual for far too long.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee? We do, Commissioner, we do have online one of your board members, Kenny Gallenhorn, calling from Dead Horse. Mr. Gallenhorn, are you there? Kenny Gallenhorn, are you there?
Yes.
Mr. Gallenhorn, can you state your name and affiliation, your association with the school board, and then go ahead and go forth with your comments?
Kenny Gallenhorn from Costaville, Alaska. I am a rural board member on the State Board of Education. And my purpose here today was mainly to listen and hopefully learn something from all you experts.
Thank you, Mr. Gallenhorn, and hopefully we can.
Nobody was laughing.
No, they were. You just didn't hear them. But we appreciate the fact that you're online. There may be other board members online, but they have not identified themselves as so. But in any case, we appreciate that. And so we're going to move into the next segment of this particular committee meeting.
Can I weigh in just on give a couple of examples of the work that. The way the practice of this board to continue with education in the state, things that they have led the way in, I think might give some ideas of their authority and their work. That's not driven directly by statute, but the authority is there. A couple of years ago, they removed the Terra Nova. It was a norm reference test that we just weren't using the data for anymore. And so they chose to remove that. They, just prior to the legislature, they actually approved variable term residential schools. For funding. Previously, only full-length, full-year programs were approved. They changed, as I mentioned, they changed the graduation requirements as to what our students would need. They had the conversation, they had begun the work on testing out as well. We know that some of these components, including the HSGQE, but those components were actually incorporated into 278. But a lot of these, the board led the way on in making those changes that they thought were important. So I wanted to give those couple of examples so that you could get an idea that they don't just wait for a statute to come through and say, do we have to do anything? They're continuing to work on making differences in education.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure I understand variable term residential. That simply means a central school that would bring students in from, say, a village for a period of a couple weeks or a month. Is that what we're talking about?
Exactly. What I would call a traditional one is they'd be there for the year or for 4 years, in essence, like our Mount Edgecombe. But we had several models around. The NACTEC up in Nome, Chugach School District has one in Anchorage, and that brought kids in for these intensives, if you will. But there was no way to fund them. We didn't provide stipends to support the housing of our kids or the feeding of our kids. So we opened the door for that, changed some regulations to allow them to be considered. And we now have three or four new ones.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd be anxious to hear how that's worked out eventually at some point as committee to learn that.
So we may request a report if you want to just file that in the memory bank, and Sheila would be in contact with you folks. Is that something that you're interested in, Senator Stevens? Yep.
Okay. Pretty straightforward. I can do that. Okay.
Any other questions or comments from the board at this point on the first part of the presentation? Seeing none, we're going to move now into the federal funds area. And for a lot of folks, just some background, whether you're a practitioner, a board member, a legislator, this is a pretty confusing area, very confusing for some. And hopefully when we get through this process, we'll understand what our relationship is with the federal government, being the legislature's relationship, what is the relationship of the state school board with the federal government, what is the, and it's particularly DOE is what I'm talking about, USDOE and Department of Education, what the commissioner's relationship is, how does money come in from the federal government, what type of grants do we have from the federal government, how are those grants spent, and for lack of a better phrase, what are we on the hook for, et cetera. So hopefully, as going through this process, we really do understand at the end of this, at least the folks here at the table and folks listening, the federal grant issue. So, Commissioner, please proceed.
Thank you. These federal programs fall directly under our Teaching and Learning Support Division, almost all of them. And Dr. McCauley has spent extensive time putting this together, so I'm going to turn it over to Dr. McCauley to present this portion.
And for the record, Susan McCauley, the Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education and Early Development, going to review three areas of federal funds. We're going to review those that are affiliated with the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. There are seven different funding programs affiliated with what we refer to frequently as ESEA, Elementary and Secondary Education Act. Going to talk about federal funds affiliated with the Individuals with Disabilities Act, frequently referred to as special education, and also with Carl Perkins Vocational Education Funds, frequently referred to as CTE, or Career and Technical Education. We'll start with the funds associated with the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. This act was passed originally for the first time in 1965 as part of President Lyndon Johnson's administration. It provides supplementary funding for elementary and secondary education, the emphasis of which is providing each child with a fair and equal opportunity for academic achievement. And that's particularly relevant when one looks at, as we will, the specific seven funding programs. They are aimed at various populations of students who may not have an equal access to education. And so the intent of this act was to hopefully address what might be some shortcomings in their education as a result of variables in these children's lives.
Let me ask you a question. So there appears to be an assumption there that the states were not doing their job back in 65, from what you just said.
Senator.
That there were holes somewhere and that the federal government was going to help fill in those holes with this grant approach.
Senator Dunleavy, it's my opinion that the holes or gaps were perceived to be a potential result of variables at work in the children's lives, not necessarily shortcomings of state departments of education in meeting the needs of children, but a link between, for example, poverty and educational achievement, migrant education status or situations and educational achievement, and the intent being to provide supplementary funding to help to ensure what is referred to as equal access to education when there are things going on in a student's life that might result in their not having equal access.
Right. And I wasn't referring to holes in the state system per se, but perceived holes that the state was not covering that you just mentioned. Because if there was an assumption that they were, there wouldn't be the words you just used earlier on.
Senator Dunleavy, the funding is supplementary funding. So it is not to be primary funding. It is to close up potential gaps that might exist without that supplementary funding.
Okay. So I'm just trying, again, we're just trying to understand the history and how we started this relationship in earnest with the federal government in 65. Thank you.
The most recent authorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act was in 2001, and that is the law that's on the books right now, No Child Left Behind, or NCLB. ESEA has not been reauthorized since 2001, and there is lots of ongoing conversation about that. We're going to look at seven federal programs as listed there on the slide, and I won't go over them because, I mean, I will go over them. I won't list them because we're about to go there.
Excuse me. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Just briefly, the question of reauthorization, does the existing statute stay in place indefinitely? Does it have a sunset? Does reauthorization mean what we would think of as amending or updating, and then it has another name?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, the law, unless amended or reauthorized, does stay on the books. The intent originally was that ESEA would be reauthorized every 5 years, and that historically has not happened according to that original intended timeline. 1994, for example, there was an official reauthorization during the Clinton administration, and it was referred to then as the Improving America's School Act. The next time that ESEA was officially reauthorized was in 2001 as No Child Left Behind. Since then, there are adjustments made by various administrations to the title programs. As you well know, there during the current administration have been permitted waivers from elements of NCLB, but what there is hope for and a lot of discussion about is a reauthorization. So that people feel that things are steady and the trajectory for the foreseeable future is set.
Thank you.
So Doctor, the law has not been reauthorized since this date. But the nature of, I don't know how you would word it, there's a waiver that we apply for. Can you explain the waiver process? Because up until this waiver process, you would hear things such as safe harbor, AMO, 100% of all schools will be labeled failing by, was it this year, next year?
2014.
There were other components of that particular, I don't know if you call it a grant, agreement. I don't know how you would refer to that. So we know that in 65 this started, the SEA. We know that in 2001 it's the same law, but it was renamed No Child Left Behind and had certain outcomes that apparently the state agreed to and other states did. And then under the current administration of the President Obama's administration, there was a morphing of this approach to things. And it kind of is a catch-all under what we call the waiver. So can you just explain briefly that? Because we don't have it in here, but just briefly explain that.
For the record, Mike Hanley, Commissioner for the Department of Education. The waiver came about when Congress continued to be far from reauthorization. And it became evident, especially to Secretary Duncan, the Secretary for the U.S. Department of Education, that it wouldn't be reauthorized, and we were moving to this point where 100% of our students needed to be proficient, and that was the year 2014. So as they weren't, our schools were deemed failing. Not restrictions on us getting funds, but how we use Title I funds in particular. School improvement plans had to be in place no matter what level of success, if you will, or proficiency, you will, that your schools had. Everyone was deemed failing. So Secretary Duncan offered a waiver from some of those components. moving from, excuse me, an adequate yearly progress model to putting our own accountability system in place, giving us some flexibility again for some of those Title I funds. That's at a high level. We could easily spend probably a half an hour talking about what we've done. It was an extensive waiver process, a little over 800 pages for us to get that waiver. Had to put some things in place to make sure we got it, but we were able to get it and get out from some of those things. And we put in a new system. You may have heard about it, the Alaska School Performance Index, ASPE, which is our five-star rating system. So we no longer say whether schools made adequate yearly progress. We rate them on a scale of 1 to 5 stars.
So one has to assume that the commissioner had the authority to change this unilaterally. You didn't have to go to Congress, correct? Because it hasn't been reauthorized. So embedded within the original appropriation and act in 01, January of 01, that flexibility must have been part of that. I'm just thinking with you.
There are members of Congress that would argue that it's still not there, and Secretary Duncan acted illegally, that he shouldn't have been able to give that waiver because it did change the law, but it hasn't
But
been.
That's not the only thing. Anyway,
correct.
So who authorized us, Alaska, to go with that waiver as opposed to stay with the course that we're on?
Through the our relationship with the USDOE, they work directly with SEAs, which are the state education agencies. That, for us, is the Department of Education. And so we have the ability to pursue that waiver.
So it wasn't through legislative action?
It didn't require legislative action. Fit well within the authority that we have and the board's vision of continuing on with promoting education. They had to adopt some regulations in regards to changes that were made.
When you say it didn't require it, the federal government, DOE didn't require it, but we did not require it through legislative action through the state of Alaska?
Correct. Okay. We did work in my relationship with the governor. We did make sure that the governor was in the loop and willing to allow us to pursue a waiver.
Again, can you just give us several major components of the waiver and how it differed from what we refer to as NCLB?
The primary issue with NCLB is there was one line of proficiency that everybody had to get above. It only recognized one level of proficiency, and for us, that score was 300, which just it was the number we chose for our assessments. It didn't measure growth. It didn't measure anything else, and if you didn't get all your kids above that line, that was what we believe was the erroneous part of No Child Left Behind, especially when we were required to hit that 100% mark. So we were able to put a couple things in place. One is, as long as we had rigorous academic standards, which we had adopted 6 months earlier, and as long as we were willing to put in our own accountability system, that was approved by the U.S. Department, and as long as we were willing to attach student learning to teacher evaluations to some extent, then if we were willing to move forward in those areas, which we had already taken steps in regards to all three of those, as long as we were willing to put those in place, then we could get a waiver and gain some, put in place a model that made more sense to Alaska. And just very briefly, our ASPE score now is based on several things, not just a proficiency of getting over a bar. Proficiency is one of them, but growth, learning growth is another one. So if you have students, schools that have very low student growth, but they're moving their kids up, you get credit for that. Attendance is a part of it. Graduation is a part of it. So all those, I think, more accurately measure how a school is doing rather than just saying, did all your kids get above this line?
So do you feel this is a profound change from what we had before under NCLB?
I don't really. I mean, it's a more effective accountability model is what it is. It's surely not a paradigm shift. When we've asked for accountability for our schools, we always have those conversations here in regards to how are our schools doing. We simply put a model in place, I believe, that makes more sense. And the thing that confirms that for me is I was a principal and a teacher for 20 years. And at some point, you get to this place where here's your AYP score for your school, and you don't know how to adjust it. You don't know how to change that. because it's just one number and it's just one line. And so, you know, if you try to change it, you find those kids that are really close to it. So you can just move them a couple of points and get them above the line. What we have now is we have principals and teachers saying, I'm a three-star school, but all I need to do is improve my attendance by this much, or all I need to do is get some of my kids to grow this much in this area. They know what it takes now to change their schools, and they have ownership in that. That's the biggest change for me, and that we've got a model that makes more sense.
Questions? Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Other states have waivers. Are you familiar with their waiver plans? Are they comparable to ours? Is this something sort of unique that we came up with? Or, I mean, when I'm looking at legislation or a problem here in this state, one of the questions I ask is, how do other people deal with it? And get a research report to that effect for.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, when waivers were first offered, there were several waves, and we didn't jump on board right away. We weren't ready to in any case, but we were able to see what other states were doing. Mm-hmm. We actually engaged in the third round of waiver offers. And so we looked extensively at what other states were doing, found something that worked for us, that works for rural and urban Alaska. We've actually made some changes since then to adequately measure some of our alternative schools for schools that bring in students that are troubled, that are at risk of dropping out. But we want them to be adequately have a model that makes sense to them as well. So I wouldn't say radically different, but it is customized for Alaska, and it is different, but there's a lot of similarities as well.
Thank you.
So, Commissioner, how would you respond to somebody if they said that it would appear to them that this system has been radically changed? New standards, new assessments, teacher accountability. What would your response be? These are some things that at least myself and I think others are getting from practitioners on the ground, and we'll probably bump into this other elephant here shortly, but what would your response be to that?
Your previous question was, does this waiver represent a radical change? And I said, I don't think it does. The standards had been adopted. The standards are a change, but I don't think they're a radical change. Those standards were driven. Our standards are what we expect of our students at each grade level. It's not how we teach. It's not the books we use. It's just what do we expect. You know, at the end of kindergarten, we want our kids to know the alphabet, uppercase and lowercase letters. We want them to be able to count to 100, things like that. So when we put those in place, those were driven by conversations not only we had here, but we've had with employers and we've had with the university. The university said 53% of our students need some type of remediation. A fifth of our students haven't been able to pass the written ASVAB exam to get into the military. Our employers are saying we're having to hire too many outside people because some of Alaska students just aren't quite ready yet. I mean, I think our NAEP scores, it's a national assessment we do every other year in fourth and eighth grade. In fourth grade, we are at the bottom. Eighth grade, we move to the middle. But at fourth grade, I think those types of things demanded some kind of response. And the response was, we need to change the trajectory. We need to change. We can't focus just on graduation. We need to focus on what our kids know when they walk across that stage so that they're ready. And that's what drove those standards. The assessments simply measure our standards. So you can't keep the same assessment in place that measured a previous set of standards. We want to make sure that we're assessing what we teach to see how well we're doing with our teaching. So radical changes, they are definitely significant. You know, we've raised the bar of what we're expecting of our teachers and our students.
Commissioner, do you think the issues you rattled off, you know, the issues with the university, remediation, mm-hmm. and developmental, et cetera, so do you believe that these changes will address those issues? And if so, do you have a timeline by which legislature can look at something and say, well, 3 years ago there were changes in the waiver and here are the outcomes now? Are you confident that that will occur?
I'm confident that our new standards will have an impact. I'm also confident that standards are not the only thing that impact the lives of our kids and our education system. But when our previous standards stopped in 10th grade and they didn't have a trajectory that aimed our kids for the next step, I know that we're now in the right place in regards to what our expectations are. So they've been in place for, this was the third year This is the first year that we'll actually measure them with our new assessment. So it may take a few years as we start to compare. This is going to be a new baseline for us this year. What I anticipate seeing that I surely wouldn't be surprised at is our scores are going to drop. We changed the bar.
That's not quite the change we were thinking.
No, but it's dropped because our expectations now are here. Our previous ones were here. I anticipate that our students are going to be here. They're going to be higher than they were before, but not quite to our new bar yet. So I think they're moving upwards, but we're going to see this drop because we've moved the bar, and appropriately so.
Questions from members of the board? Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think this is a very significant discussion. You've used the word significant, but I didn't mean to borrow that again. But as I've read through Common Core, and I'm not a certificate of teacher at all, and that's not my background, but I see things like, it's just, as I recall, I may be wrong, but like at the seventh grade, a student should be able to write an essay to convince someone else of his position. Doesn't tell them what position to take. Pro-abortion, anti-abortion doesn't say that. You just write an essay. Now, that's a remarkable thing, and I would think that every kid should be able to do that. And so I think what you've said is very important. This is not a radical change. This is carrying on what we've expected. We've had higher expectations. It's significant. And I think, would you agree then that Common Core standards, as we are Alaska standards, are in fact significant but not radical? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, I think that that's a fair statement, that they are a significant difference. Changing that trajectory, as it's the term I tend to use, raising the expectations. But there's not suddenly a whole bunch of new things that students have to learn. It's just in the rate that they learn them, which allows more room at the top to learn more things to get them prepared. I hesitate to use this because it's oversimplified. But if we were to take the standards that we had previously and we just kind of shifted them down a little bit, it's oversimplified. But what students in fourth grade were previously learning, we're seeing now on the plates of our third graders. We didn't just do this. There are a lot of other things, because what we also changed is not just a matter of knowing, but being able to do and demonstrate. So in practice, can you demonstrate some of these things? And can you be able to write a paragraph or a statement that justifies a position? So, yes, I would agree with you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The example that Senator Stevens used, you know, I once upon a time paid a lot of attention to, as we were going through here in the state, the different programs to figure out how students were really doing. And we then, I'll just use the crass term that I believe at the time, we dumbed down the test because we couldn't stand the results. Right? That's what I believe. And when you get to the written portion of it, I feel 110% confident in what I'm fixing to say. It's the easiest one to subjectively give people greater credit than their skill deserves. I believe that. Because you go almost any school you want to and set a number of students down and have them write, and you go, ooh, this is kind of scary. That's not good, bad, or indifferent, but the writing component's the easiest. Now, you know, unfortunately in our society, if you look at math, you go, oh my goodness, we don't do very good, because it's the most difficult to give people constructive credit for thinking hard on the equation and not getting the right answer. But having said that, in the context of what you're describing, the thing I almost found humorous with the present administration, which will be in office for 8 years, and poking at No Child Left Behind. I'm not trying to defend No Child Left Behind. It has plenty of things to poke at. But instead of putting a program into effect, they chose to waiver an old program. That's an interesting concept. And so, you know, why are we where we are in education, K through 12? In my opinion, I just mentioned a couple of them. We've got a little ways to go. In my opinion.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I would wholeheartedly agree. We really stand by and we are encouraging a reauthorization. to go through this waiver process and having states doing all these different things is a little bit odd. And I will tell you that I believe that Senator Murkowski has been a real friend for us as a Department of Education. She's on the HELP committee and does extensive work and is currently working on some reauthorization. It seems like it has life again, but we'll see.
So, and I'm not, this particular committee meeting, we won't make it a common core discussion or Alaska core discussion, whatever, that may occur here in the near future. But for today, so we're going to keep going through the grants, but the authority to get the grants, I believe, was ceded by the legislature many years ago to the department and the school board. We then have to come back and we approve those expenditures, because that's our job under the Constitution, through the federal receipt process when we're dealing with budgets. So, correct me if I'm wrong, the department gets to decide, because of legislation, authority that was ceded to the department, whether they're going to have a waiver, whether they're not going to have a waiver, how this is going to look, et cetera, et cetera. But in the end, ultimately, it's the legislature that either approves or does not approve receiving that funding and passing that funding through. Is that how you see it?
Yes, the legislature approves the receipt. You know, we have to get the authority for those receipts.
Is it something to think about that in the future, if there are changes that, and maybe you did this, maybe this was prior to my arrival, but that you go to the legislature and say, we're thinking about changing this, and before we change it, we want to make sure that you're kind of with it, because you will have to be the ones that approve the actual funding for it.
There have been no increased requests for authority for receipts due to our waiver or any of our recent actions. And that's been a confusion a lot of people have had, that you've done all this work and now you're asking us for the money. And there aren't any situations. I would surely caution the board if they were to do something like that. There are no situations that the board has taken an action that's required us to come back to the legislature. I take that back. We have the authority to approve residential schools. And there is, we've just recently approved one, and there is a request for funding for that school to the legislature. But aside from that, as far as federal receipts, we didn't require additional funding for our standards. We didn't require additional funding for our assessments. There was no funding tied to our waiver.
No, I'm sorry. Maybe I misspoke. What I'm saying is you can agree to a waiver. You can. The authority lies with you because it was ceded by the legislature.
Right.
But the legislature, theoretically speaking, may not agree with receiving the funds to put that waiver in place. In other words, the legislature retains this authority. It has to. We expend funds. We have to expend the funds.
Right. And appropriately so. But
appropriate the funds, I'm sorry.
But there are no funds tied to our waiver. What Dr. McCauley will walk through here today was in place prior to our waiver and is still in place. That authority was given years ago when our waiver came in place. Nothing else happened. So there was no additional authority needed, no additional funding that came.
Okay.
I'm aware of that, and I think that that's a healthy balance for this legislature to have a say over budget and in essence, authority over a direction that's going to cost the state money.
Okay. It was just a question, because there was a concern that earlier you had mentioned how there was it's questionable whether Arne Duncan had the right to change the nature of what was No Child Left Behind.
Right.
And so if it was questionable for him to change the nature of that, we accepted through the department that questionable authority change, and then we still have to approve or appropriate the expenditure of federal receipts to support that. That's all I was driving at. So why don't we keep going through the grants, all the grants that we have and what they do?
Start with Title I. There are four specific Title I programs. Again, the purpose of Title I funds was to ensure that all students have the opportunity to receive a fair and equal education. The first...
Excuse me. Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry. This is very basic. But could you give me a definition of disadvantaged? Are we only talking about financial disadvantage, or
the through the chair, Senator Stevens, the funding mechanism for Title I is based on poverty, and we'll talk here in a moment about how that is determined. But for this funding source in particular, the driver, so to speak, is to address the needs of children living in poverty.
Thank you.
So the first slide eight, the first program, the largest program, is Title I-A. It's basically referred to as the basic Title I program. It provides assistance to local educational agencies and schools with high numbers or high percentages of children from low-income families. So as we move through these title programs, again, as I stated a little bit ago, it's interesting to see what is the population of student who these funds are attempting to address. And for Title I basic programs, the population of students are those living in poverty. Again, to help ensure that students are meeting high state academic standards. Eligibility, all SEAs we refer to a lot, that's State Education Agency, that's the Department of Education.
Excuse me, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, excuse me, it's along the same lines that Senator Stevens asked question. The high number, I assume there is a number that represents high number. What is that number?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, there's a funding formula that has to do with what constitutes a high number that is relatively complicated, but I'll attempt to simplify it. The federal law requires that if a school has 75% or more of its population of low-income children, that school must be served with Title I funds. The floor for serving with some flexibility is 35%. Districts have discretion. When they receive their Title I funding, they have discretion with where they set their own floor. However, again, if a school has 75% or more of its students who are low-income students, they must serve that school with Title I funds. So there's a range there and a, like I said, quite a complicated funding formula that goes with it all.
I mean, just for curiosity, at some point later on, if you could provide me the number of elementary schools in Mat-Su School District that's Title I. And what that number equates to that qualifies them for Title I.
Can do that. And just to reiterate, through the chair, Senator Huggins, the percentage, the threshold for percentage of students who are low income set by Mat-Su will be different than that set by other districts. They do have discretion within that range. So again, eligibility, the driver for the amount of funding it's a formula that is based on census data connected to income, and then at the school level, free and reduced lunch data.
Do you know what the amount of money is that we get for Title I total for the state?
At the, Chair Dunleavy, at the bottom of the slide, $38,150,000. Is our total amount for this specific Title I program. So the requirements of what does a district or a school or the Department of Education have to do in order to be compliant with the use of these funds, they need to develop a plan that identifies strategies to address the needs of low-achieving students. Once those funds are allocated, the funds are permitted to be used for students who are not low-income students. That's simply a driver for the funding mechanic or mechanism. The requirements for how those funds are used is that they must be used in ways that will address the needs of low-achieving students, whether or not those students are students who are receiving free or reduced lunch. So schools, districts, the Department of Education develop a plan documenting how they will do that. The last bullet there, I have some examples of some typical ways that these funds are spent. They can provide tutoring for children. They can provide for staff to, for example, conduct small group instruction with students who are struggling. They can pay for instructional materials. They can pay for professional development for staff. They can pay for programs or strategies to increase parental involvement. There is a list of allowable activities that can be funded with Title I funds. The second of the four Title I programs are school improvement grants. These are grants that go out to LEAs, are local educational agency. I was going to say association. Agency, those are our districts. So these are grant funds that go out to LEAs, districts, for assistance with school improvement for the lowest performing schools. Again, there is a formula by which we receive funding, and then LEA's districts are able to submit applications for competitive grants for these funds. And just skip to the bottom, you can see that the yearly funding for this is much, much smaller. It's about $1.5 million. The third title program is Title I-C, the education of migratory children, the population.
Senator Gardner.
Excuse me, can we go back up to the school improvement grants? Mm-hmm. And under requirements, and one of the suggestions is early learning, and what exactly is meant by that in this context?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, we are in fact waiting to find that out.
Okay.
The regulations, there's a new round of what we refer to as SIG, school improvement grants, a new round of SIG funding for which the Department of Education and in turn, our districts who choose to apply would be eligible. And the regulations governing what a receiving district or school must do are changing. They are in draft right now. And so we are aware that they are going to change up the models that must be implemented by a district, in a school, by a district that receives these funds. And one of them is referred to, the title is an early learning model, but we do not yet know the specifics of what that looks like because those regulations are not done.
Thank you.
So the slide 10, Migrant Ed, Title I-C, population of students here who are the target of these, target's not the right word, the focus of these funds are migrant students. Helping them to overcome challenges of mobility, frequent absences, late enrollment, social isolation, and various things that may be associated with living a migratory life.
So, Doctor, we don't have a lot of fruit-picking families in Alaska. So how do we qualify for this? Because if my history serves me, that was the purpose of this, was migrant children that were members of a family that were moving throughout the country picking fruit or vegetables. How does this apply to Alaska? Is it fishermen, fisher people, fisherwomen, fishers? Can you help us understand that?
Chair Dunleavy, if we want an absolutely correct technical answer, I would call up our program administrator.
I don't. Obviously, we qualify, even though we don't have a lot of pickers or fishers, pickers. Okay. So it would be interesting to find out how we qualify. I mean, I know we do.
I'm Chair Dunlap. I'm hesitant to offer what may the answer I have in my head that may or may not be absolutely technically correct.
Does anyone have a real quick answer? Because I don't want to get bogged down on this. Just a quick one. And you are?
I am Margaret McKinnon, Title I Administrator for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you.
And the primary activities that qualify are fishing, agriculture, dairy. In Alaska, most of our qualifications come from fishing, and a large part of that would be subsistence fishing.
Dairy, fishing, and?
Agriculture, picking crops.
So we do have pickers in Alaska that qualify?
Those are qualified. Those are legally qualified activities under the federal law. We don't have any dairy people qualifying in Alaska. We do have some berry picking will qualify, and fishing are our primary activities.
Okay, thank you. Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So a family that maybe spends part of their time in rural in a small rural community and moves to Anchorage periodically back and forth. I know we do have some families who do that. The fact that they move a lot, change schools, doesn't qualify them in and of itself for being migratory and getting these services.
They have to move and engage in one of the allowable activities.
Thank you. I would suppose that the disruption is equivalent regardless of the reason for the move. But
any idea how many fishers and pickers we have in terms of qualifying this? Five, ten, thousands?
Chair Dunleavy, we have approximately between 10 and 11,000 in our state.
Thank you.
And primarily, Mr. Chairman, as I understand, it's subsistence fishing. That would be the primary reason that people would be considered migratory at the 11,000.
Commercial fishing also qualifies, but most of our population qualifies under subsistence fishing. They go out to fish camp.
Would it be safe to say, if we really clarify that, it's 10 to 11,000 individuals who filled out the form in a manner that they qualify for this?
Yes, that were identified by districts as meeting the eligibility requirements.
Yeah, that is.
So some of us don't see an army of pickers and fishers. It's filling out the form the right way.
Yes.
Thank you.
The process is to identify the students and then verify their eligibility through filling out paperwork.
Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, fishing to me is always an interesting one because fishing is in the summertime and school is out in the summertime, and they're not exactly congruent.
The pickers are too, right, Senator? We're not growing crops in the middle of winter. It's all summertime.
Well, the fall time is when you pick the crops.
Which is August here. Anyway. Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions? Anyone else? Thanks.
The amount of funding, Susan McCauley again, Director of Teaching and Learning Support, the amount of funding for the Title I-C program is $6.8 million. The last of the four Title I programs is prevention and intervention programs for children and youth who are neglected, delinquent, or at risk. This funding goes to districts that have a correctional institution that serves students in K-12 education within their district boundaries. LEA's districts are eligible for funding based on the number of students served within those facilities, and it is to provide supplementary educational services. There must already be an educational component happening within these institutions in order to qualify for additional supplementary funding. The amount of funding received by the state of Alaska is $250,000. We go on to, we're done with Title I. We're in Title II, and this is teacher and principal training and recruiting. The purpose is as stated there. It is focused on improving teacher and principal quality is the way the federal law is worded. The state Department of Education and our districts are eligible, again, based on formula-driven funds, programs that are operated through these funds. Lots of times have to do with professional development. That is what I've seen most frequently in my work in districts, is that they are used by districts to provide professional development to their staff. The amount of funding provided to the state of Alaska, most of which goes to districts, is $10.8 million.
Sure.
Senator Stevens.
Is that the mentor program? Is that included in this, the mentoring programs that we have in the state?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. The mentoring program is, at this point, mostly funded through general funds. However, mentoring is an allowable activity for funding through Title IIA. And we are permitted to use some of the state administration funds, meaning those retained in the Department of Education, for the mentoring project.
Thank you.
The other
Senator Huggins, excuse me.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. McCauley. My question will be on highly qualified teachers and student achievement, right? We've made a significant effort to get bulk up on highly qualified teachers, to get people there. Have we seen any corresponding movement in how our students are doing? You don't have to answer that right now, but I would be interested to see if there is something that shows that we're getting some payoff for what we did. It's a good effort. I appreciate that. Sometimes hard to quantify.
So, Senator, just to clarify, is that a report on mentoring outcomes?
Well, not necessarily. Mentoring is a sub-element of it, but I mean, education is part of it, the testing part for the teachers. And to be quite frank, though, the other part I think we would all be interested in, what highly qualified means in certain levels of education through K-12, because they're different. It's a sliding scale.
Thank you.
The second of the Title II programs, Math and Science Partnerships, these two are competitive grants. Total funding available for those is $750,000. The department is able to offer a competitive grant process to districts who wish to apply. There are, of course, requirements. They require partnering with what is referred to as a high needs LEA or high needs district, institution of post-secondary education for the specific purpose of improving the achievement of students in math and science.
Doctor, I apologize to the committee and folks watching this, but I should have asked for, I should have mentioned that we'll try and minimize acronyms, and you're doing a good job, but once again, SEA stands for what, so folks understand?
State Education Agency.
Which would be the department.
Yes.
And an LEA stands for what?
Local Education Agency.
Which would be a what?
District.
Hmm? Okay, so you'll have some grants that are only eligible for an SEA, you'll have some grants that are only eligible for an LEA, and you may have grants that are eligible for both.
Chair Dunleavy, of all of the grants that we've talked about thus far, those are both the Department of Education and districts are eligible for those funds. And the department's primary role with regard to those funds is to get them out to districts.
Thanks.
Title III of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act funds is focused on limited English proficient students, what we refer to as LEP students, limited English proficient. And the purpose is pretty straightforward. It's to increase English proficiency and academic achievement of those students. The Department of Education, again, is eligible for formula-driven funds. Our districts, in order to receive them, must have a minimum number of limited English proficient students in order to qualify for funding. If they qualify for that funding and receive it, it is to be used to provide language instruction, programs, or professional development to staff related to improving the achievement of limited English proficient students. The amount of funding we receive, the department receives, currently is $1.2 million. Title IV, Section B, is 21st Century Community Learning Centers. These are to expand collaborations between districts and community learning centers to provide academic enrichment opportunities. Probably one of the best known examples that ends up receiving funding through this title program are Boys and Girls Clubs. So the way this looks potentially is that it facilitates transportation from a local school to this after school program through an approved program that has connection to attempting to provide academic enrichment to students. The amount of funding we receive currently is $5.6 million.
Do you have data that shows how successful this approach is?
Chair Dunleavy, data that we collect is connected to completion of grant activities primarily. So we are involved in approving those activities, collecting data to show that the activities occurred, and collecting evaluation data for them. The activities are not, to my knowledge, collating the data for that to show an aggregate improvement for all programs. We are looking individually program by program to see if what they said they were going to do, they did, whether they've conducted an evaluation, and whether there are data that show that.
So you're evaluating the delivery and not necessarily the outcome.
Chair Dunleavy, our primary role is to monitor for compliant use of funding, that it was used in the manner in which it was supposed to be used.
Okay, so I'm just saying we don't know if it's we don't know if there's a model out there that is actually helping to improve academics. Do we have data that demonstrates there's a model?
I'm going to defer to our program administrator, who is the one looking at those grant applications. I'm sorry. We're going to need to bring up the Deputy Director of Teaching and Learning Support. If we're going to move into program administration level, that's what we're going to need. It's your pleasure.
If you can come up and give us a quick yes, no, and if it's a yes, which, where, and if not, it's a no. Please state your name for the record.
Paul Pressing, Deputy Director of Teaching and Learning Support. I think the model is the 21st Century Community Learning Center model. There shows there's a strong connection to after-school programs, can increase student achievement. What we have statewide is, like Dr. McCauley mentioned, individual programs. You know, we've noticed that if kids show up on a regular basis, there are improvements based on the measures that they've written in their applications. But as far as one particular model, I would say that's just an after-school model.
So that's no?
A yes.
And do you have an example, a place, something that you hold up that you look at and say we should model things after this particular place?
Well, again, not going in, Senator Chair Dunleavy, not going into specific details. I think our Anchorage, our Amatsu, our Fairbanks, we have one in Kenai through the Boys and Girls Club. They're all showing positive trends towards the target and what they're doing.
Okay, thanks. Questions? Senator Stevens.
My familiarity with after-school programs is in the smallest villages in our state, where the schools are used for everything, and it's a community center, and if there's a potluck or a city council meeting or whatever, it often happens at the school. So those communities really use the school, you know, all the time and year-round. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about Boys and Girls Clubs, which are primarily the larger communities. Do I understand that right? So funding for after-school programs in a village like Akiak would not come under this, but funding for Boys and Girls Clubs in Mat-Su would come under this, right?
Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, the list of districts that receive funding under this title program are the larger districts.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to clarify, Boys and Girls Club is just one of the nonprofits that is eligible to apply for these funds. The majority of the applicants are districts providing these services.
Thank you.
Title VI, flexibility and accountability. The purpose here is to allow the Department of Education and districts to target federal funds to programs that effectively address the needs of states and localities. There are three programs that we will go over briefly. Title VIA, improving academic achievement. The language is to pay the cost of the development and implementation of state assessments and standards that are required by the Department of Education. All state educational agencies are eligible for $3 million of funding, with additional funding prorated based on census data. The requirement are plans to develop, implement, and disseminate information about state assessments and standards.
Does this grant cover the assessments, the standardized assessments that are being developed and will be administered here in the near future?
Chair Dunleavy, this does not cover in full the cost of those assessments. It pays for approximately 50%.
50%?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Title VIA is Small Rural School Achievement Program. This is one of two options available. It is either this program or the one that I will go over on slide 19. The intent is to address the unique needs of rural school districts that frequently lack what we kind of call economies of scale. They lack the ability to apply for enough competitive grants where the amount received would actually make any money. And what is really allowed by this grant is flexible use of the funding provided by all of the programs I just went over.
There's a grant?
There are grant funds.
That helps you spend other grant money.
Chair Dunleavy, there are grant funds and the ability for flexible use of other grant funds, yes.
You understand that?
Let me give you an example, if I might.
Sure.
In the Department of Education's budget is $20,000. That is because we run Mount Edgecombe. That is the only reason that Department of Education has any funds affiliated with this title program in our budget at all. Otherwise, these funds go directly to school districts from the U.S. Department of Education. So these funds are an additional $20,000 for, in this case, Mount Edgecombe, which is the only reason we're really talking about this, is because it is in our budget, and then their ability to pull the funds for Title I-A, Title II, Title III, to pull them together and to use them collectively for any of the allowable activities for any of those title programs. The purpose, again, or the thinking there, is that because some of our districts are so small, the amount of funding that they generate, since the driver for it ends up in some cases being number of students, the amount is so small in these individual title programs that arguably it's not going to have much impact. The idea here is that it can be pulled together and used across those programs so that there is hopefully more impact. The other option is this second title program, Title 6B, which is Rural and Low Income School Program. This program, one, a district is eligible for only if they are not already eligible for the one we just went over. And what would preclude their eligibility for the first one is a population size that exceeds the definition of small rural, but with some other factors that make them small and rural. The only example of how this is operating in the state is the Lower Kuskokwim School District. And because Bethel is in that school district, when the size of that community exceeded 5,000, it knocked them out of the qualifying criteria for the first one. And so they then are eligible for this second program, which again allows for some flexible use of funding for title programs, as well as additional grant funds, and in their case it is $88,000.
So is it reasonable to think of these two programs that you call flexible use are basically kind of getting like waivers for the Title I funds or the Title III funds, and they can use them for still acceptable uses within those guidelines?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that would be an accurate way to look at it. Not waivers from what are allowable uses, but waivers from Title I's funds must be used for these activities, Title III for these activities. It just allows the pooling of those so that they can be used for any of the allowable activities within each of them individually.
So if you're a small qualifying school under Title 6B, 2, and you have funds for Title I, or you have, I'm getting the titles mixed up, but you have funds, for example, for after-school programs, and you have funds for somebody's English as a second language, use different phraseology, you could pull them together and say our most pressing need is for the language instruction, and we won't worry about the other for right now.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's correct.
Thank you.
Final title program is Title 10, Homeless Education. The focus group of students of this funding are students who are homeless. The state Department of Education is eligible based on the number of students identified as homeless children. Local educational agencies, our districts, are eligible through a competitive grant process, and the activities are those that would serve homeless children. Assistance with transportation, clothing, laundry, there's actually a pretty broad list of acceptable activities that can be used with this funding. Currently, the amount of funding that the Department of Education receives is $170,000.
Do you know how many homeless children we have that have been identified?
I don't, Senator Dunleavy. I can tell you that the qualifying districts, meaning they need to have met a threshold for that and have applied, are Anchorage, Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and Kenai. Those are the only four districts that receive these funds. I don't know the number of homeless children in the state of Alaska.
And are these homeless like we think homeless, meaning they're out on the street, sleeping on the street, or is it, again, a certain way you fill out the form that qualifies you to be homeless? Do we have children that really don't sleep on the streets but sleep in homes that are homeless?
Chair Dunleavy, the two things. The definition of homeless is not as strict as you as what you gave an example of. We refer to some homeless children as couch surfing. They don't have a permanent home where they go back to every night that provides them with a stable environment, and they come into school every day. They may be living temporarily here, then temporarily here, then temporarily here, and that would meet the definition of homeless for the purpose of these funds. The other component of that with regard to the completion of paperwork is that part of what's required for a Department of Education qualify for these funds is having a homeless education coordinator, and districts are then required to have these, in order to get these funds, to have a homeless liaison where they are actively identifying students who meet the definition of homeless. So I just wanted to make sure that the impression is not that in order to qualify for these funds, students or their families would need to be filling out paperwork. That paperwork requirement exists, but it's the responsibility of educators who are serving these students and the Department of Education who are serving our educators, not a paperwork requirement for those we hope are benefiting from these services.
Senator.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCauley, it appeared that the school district would have to have two personnel to be eligible for this grant. Is that correct? You said that a coordinator and I'll call it outreach or liaison. Is that did I hear correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, the coordinator is a Department of Education staff member.
Okay.
The liaison is a district staff member.
Okay.
I am not aware whether or not that would require a full-time staff member. They are required to have identified a liaison.
Right. Okay. So my real question, so that there's $170,000 that is available to four school districts, the way you described it. Those coordinators we were talking about, do they come out of the $170,000, or is it additional monies that are available given funding for those already? Does that make sense? So you're not debiting for those positions. It's additional stuff that you can buy with $170,000.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, my understanding is that the staff that are required to be in place are, in fact, funded through those grant funds.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see what that equals. In other words, how much money is really available beyond personnel cost?
They're most likely split funded, wouldn't you think? Mm-hmm. If it's one FTE and it's at least one or at least two or more fund sources for two or more specific purposes and focus?
Chair Dunleavy, that's what I am picturing. When I think about the way that districts go about work affiliated with operation of these title programs, in many cases, they are have responsibilities related to more than one title program.
So we have three more grants, but before we do that, if we can get the total amount of money spent on all these grants, and then what is the match realistically in reality? What is the match for each of these grants that is required to fully implement the grant. In other words, if we see $92 million worth of federal money, how much state money has to be put into that to match it by requirement or actually make it functional? Please. Thank you. That's all the grants. Okay.
So those are the grants affiliated with the education, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, those seven programs. There are three more that fall under the topic for today's meeting, and that is federal programs. So the large federal program is related to the Individuals with Disabilities Act. That is what we refer to frequently as special education. The purpose of that is, I think, clear and obvious, and that is to ensure that students with disabilities have available to them a free and appropriate public education. All departments of education in the country and all districts are eligible for this funding. It is based on number of students in the district and number of students living in poverty. Again, there is an interesting funding formula that generates the amount of funding, but then, of course, the funds must be used, in this case, to serve students with disabilities, special education students. This is a very complicated area of federal law with a lot of requirements for how students must be served. The funds are used to support, under requirements there, the identification and support of students with disabilities or for students aged birth to 2 years with developmental delays. The amount of funding that the state receives is $36 million. For the general program and $1.1 million for the preschool program.
Do we know when this came into existence? We know that ESEA was 65. Do we know when IDEA came into existence?
If I look at my piece of paper, I do. It was originally Senator Dunleavy. The origin of what is now IDEA was in 75.
75.
And it was then called the Education of All Handicapped Children Act. It became the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, in 1990. But the origin is 1975.
And this covers individuals, again, from what age to what age, up to what age?
From birth to 21.
21. So it could follow them to post-secondary programs as well.
The final program is Carl Perkins Vocational and Applied Technology Education Act. That's the name of the act from which these funds originated. We refer to these as CTE funds. The purpose is, as stated there, to develop academic, vocational, and technical skills of secondary students and post-secondary students. The eligibility is that a Department of Education is based on the state's population. Districts have to have a sufficient number of students in order to generate a minimum allocation of $15,000. The requirements are that they have to develop plans to strengthen the academic and career and technical education skills of CTE students. So this is a relatively small program. In terms of the federal funds we received, it is $4.2 million.
So are there new plans for the use of Carl Perkins?
I'm sorry, Senator Dunleavy.
Are there any? Do you have new plans? The ESEA was NCLB, then it Arne Duncan somehow was able to change that. We're still figuring that out. And then it morphed into back to ESEA and waivers. We have Carl Perkins. Is Carl Perkins going to look the same way it did 5 years ago? Do you have plans to change Carl Perkins? Are you going to use it as a block grant? Is it going to be very specific?
Chair Dunleavy, there are not federal changes to this program. There is a conversation about how best to utilize the relatively small amount of funding we have in the state of Alaska for CTE. Currently, funding goes out to districts based on the number of students they have. The challenge there is that federal law and part of our monitoring requires that programs have sufficient size, scope, and quality to be effective. And because many of our districts are so small, and they are only qualifying for a minimal amount of funding, $15,000, it is very challenging to have a program of sufficient size, scope, and quality to be effective with so little funding. So there's ongoing conversation at the Department of Education about how best to utilize the funding we receive while also allowing for it to meet the local needs of the districts that receive it. And those needs vary pretty dramatically across our state in terms of the kinds of activities they want to support or the focus of those activities. So there aren't changes coming down to us in terms of use of these funds. There is discussion about how best to use these funds in a state like Alaska with small amount of funding and even smaller when it goes out to districts and hits their budgets.
These were instructional and academic grants. Do you have other grants that go through the department that go to schools? Transportation grants, lunch, breakfast grants, technology grants, infrastructure grants?
Chair Dunleavy, the two other grant programs that arguably qualify as federal grant programs but are not of the same nature, and therefore we did not include them, was the school lunch program. It's not a program related to, at least not directly, education, and it is provides for food for children. We, just in our discussion with you, did not include it here because we didn't feel that that was the intended purpose of today's meeting. The other are Head Start funds, and those funds go directly to Head Start agencies. And again, while those are federal programs, they didn't seem to hang together in the way that these do in terms of the Department of Education's role for both allocating the funding to districts and monitoring for use of that funding. So those two programs are federal programs. They just are of a different nature than all of these others that we've discussed.
Questions? We're getting towards the end here. I'm going to probably send some written questions to the department, but I would like to see all the grants, the amounts, again, state match. So we can get an idea. When you were talking about Carl Perkins, it reminded me that I think in the state of the state, I think the governor was talking about vocational education or CTE. Since we tried to understand what the relationship is of the commissioner to the board, the commissioner to us, the commissioner to the governor, et cetera, so if the governor said, well, I would like to see more money or more focus, more money into CTE, how does that process manifest itself? I mean, we kind of know that it'll come through the department, but is that authority that's in the laws, or is that one of those relationship assumption things?
Senator Dunleavy, are you speaking specifically to the governor's references?
If the governor wants somebody to spearhead a change in educational policy, how does that work from the moment the governor thinks about that till it lands on our desk as a possible bill or changing some of these grants like ARNA does?
There are several ways that we could go about it. It could be done statutorily to change programs. There are very few that would be done regulatorily that would require funding. We just don't put those forward that happen in regulation that require funding. Hypothetically, if there were additional, let's say we Carl Perkins changed and we had the ability to get a different round to expand our CTE, would we have the ability to do that? We would need to get the authority for those receipts, but it wouldn't require legislative action necessarily. We already have this type of federal program. It fits within our mission and our authority So it's kind of a hypothetical as to what we would, how we would go about that. I will say that the governor's vision in regards to specifically what he spoke about is in this fiscal climate, how do we increase our opportunities? And he has a vision of really collaborating specifically with private entities, employers who will come alongside of education to help us train students for the jobs that that employer is looking for. So he was looking at some private-public partnerships and expanding those.
And trying to look, once again, in statute for the authority that outlines that. So if theoretically speaking, if the governor wanted something to happen and your board didn't necessarily agree with it, how does that play itself out? Because you're hired, you work for the board.
And the governor, correct. Subject to the approval of the governor. So in practice, my daily work requires my work with the governor. And so the boots on the ground work that the department does is with the governor. And I follow the guidance of our Department of Education, who provides policy decisions or not policy decisions, but specific decisions within their authority on things like vocational ed, on areas that we want to pursue, very long-term programs and things like that. But my everyday work is the work I do with the department as authorized, as expected from the board. It is an interesting relationship. In essence, the board is appointed by the governor. And I'm appointed by the board, at the subject to the approval of the governor. In essence, we are all a part of the executive branch that is headed by the governor. So we typically, although only four members can be of the same party as the governor, we would anticipate that there's some alignment between the state board and the governor's vision. He surely has the ability to change that out as needed.
We're getting towards the end. Questions? We're going to finish up early. Comments?
Bob, this is sort of an odd thing, but I was thinking as we talked about Title 10 and the number of students that we have homeless, we don't really know the number of students that we have. I've heard anecdotal comments in some small communities of students that are sleeping on someone's couch, a friend or aunt or an uncle, and teachers who go out of their way to make sure this kid is taken care of. So I know that doesn't fit into the grant program. I know that's beyond the pale of what we're talking about, but I think it should be recognized that the teachers in the department go beyond the job to take care of these kids.
Agreed. Senator Dunleavy, what I would suggest, if you haven't looked at, we didn't really bring them up today, but I know they're a part of your packet, is how these federal programs translate into each of your districts. So Senator Huggins reminded me, and you're asking about the Title I schools in MATSU. I was just kind of going through that. We don't have it broken down by schools, but you can see the impact of, and when we started talking about migrant funds, I was looking for, Bristol Bay has some, the commercial fishing area, the Aleutians region has, so those are in your packet as well to see how that impacts, these programs impact your districts.
Thank you. Board Member Gallahorn, are you still with us? Board Member Gallahorn, are you still with us? So with that, are there any other board members online? So with that, our next meeting is going to be next Tuesday, February 3rd, and it's going to we're going to have the State Board of Education present its annual report. And there have been some bills filed, and we'll start getting some bills in the mix here, and we'll start hearing bills. There's going to be more requests for hearings. Our office has been in contact with your office, but some of the questions that we brought up, if we can get that information, that'd be great. Any comments before we adjourn? Senator Giesel, Senator Huggins, Senator Gardner? Thank you very much, and we are adjourned.